From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. On today's show, we're going to talk with an Emory University professor who went head-to-head with a Holocaust denier in one of the most high-profile libel cases in history.
It's hard stuff that I'm asking people to do, but in this age of truthiness, in this age of where facts don't matter and I have a right to my opinion, well, you may have a right to your opinion, but if your opinion is based in a lie, it's not an opinion, it's a lie. We have to be willing to challenge that. Otherwise, far more than just the history of the Holocaust is at stake.
That's coming up this hour, but first, we listened back yesterday to our conversation with bloggers about the dating scene in Atlanta. Census data shows there were 80,000 more single women than single men in Atlanta last year. Brittany Manson, who writes about her dating life in the blog Alone in Atlanta, told us about an online dating match who was juggling multiple women.
Clearly, he has options, and he has so many that he doesn't even have to take the time to remember who his options are, because where one falls off, another one will just pick right up. So I definitely think that there's a power shift right now, and it's in the male's favor.
Well, here are your first thoughts. Mary tweets, "That's all. In the 90s, it was much worse. 11 single women to each single man. Went 3 years without a date with an eligible man." Paul Fenner emailed us to say, in part, "In pursuit of equality, women have gotten what they have asked for. Men view them as equal. They are no longer something special to be won or to chase or to work for. They are just like one of the guys. They talk like sailors. They want to have sex without commitment. They want to compete with them, etc. Women are not partners, nor do they bring something unique to the relationship that men can't have otherwise. They have become competitors." Or so ends Paul's quote there. Not Adam speaking just then, Paul Fenner. Let's get that clear. We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. Well, NPR host Steve Inskeep made a recent trip to Georgia to speak with several voters ahead of the first presidential debate. One of those voters was Jimmy Arno. Jimmy is an auto mechanic from Lawrenceville. He told Inskeep that he has considered joining a militia group if Hillary Clinton becomes president.
It's a militia group. And should martial law, civil war, whatever break out in this country, they will uphold the Constitution and rebuild our laws.
What war do you mean?
The war that's going to take place when Hillary Clinton's elected, if that happens.
What sort of a war would that be?
Your patriots.
Your patriots are going to overthrow the government.
Okay. Well, Arno's comments are part of an emerging trend. The Southern Poverty Law Center reports that the number of anti-government militia groups has grown by more than one-third since 2014. Ryan Lenz is a senior writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for talking us through this and helping us understand this phenomenon. First of all, how do you guys define militia group?
Well, militia groups are organized groups that advocate or that hold anti-government extremist positions and generally espouse a number of conspiracy theories. These are namely the conspiracies that just heard in that soundbite, conspiracy theories about a war with the federal government about to break out, conspiracy theories about the federal government selling out American sovereignty in favor of globalist agendas. It really runs the gamut.
Well, they're not just groups that are defined by their beliefs. They're also defined by their actions or their intended actions and the fact that many of them are preparing to take violent action, right?
That is absolutely true. Militia groups are groups that arguably or argue to themselves and to those to anyone who listen that they'll stand up to defend the Constitution should it come under attack. In the last couple of years, we've seen militias become really a front and center issue, especially surrounding the Bundy family out in Nevada, both in 2014 when Cliven Bundy the elder, the patriarch of the family, stood down the Bureau of Land Management over an issue of public lands. Militias were instrumental in providing the military horsepower or the threat force behind Cliven Bundy, and the same is the case in Malheur, the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon. So this sort of high exposure that militias have in that have done a lot to make people think that they're a solution to a problem that they might perceive to exist.
Just before we proceed from this point about trying to define what militias are, I feel that I should ask, would not some of the groups that we talk about when we talk about militias better be described as terrorist organizations, organizations that are using violence or threat of violence to advance political change? I worry sometimes that maybe, frankly, people like me and the media tend to call people militias when they're white and terrorists when they're brown.
Well, I think that's a great point. I mean, these militias ultimately serve as, you know, the military wing of an agenda that is, you know, that is far right. And as such, partially because of the threat that they provide, you know, without a doubt that it's a domestic terrorist organization. That's especially true in the aftermath of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge takeover. I mean, these were so-called quote unquote patriots who stood up against the federal government with this backing, and they were threatening to kill or be killed if their demands were not met. You know, if terrorism is defined as the threat of violence or violence itself for the furtherance of political agendas, absolutely, these organizations are domestic terrorists.
So the Southern Poverty Law Center has documented a 1/3 increase in the number of militia groups since 2014. How do you track these things?
Largely through open source records. You know, these are groups that advertise themselves publicly. They put themselves online. They seek recruits. It's really not that difficult to find where these groups are.
Yeah. Is 2014 just when you started counting, or was that some kind of historical inflection point? Did activity really pick up around then?
Well, I think activity really picked up around 2014, you know, surrounding the Clive and Bundy issue. But it's important to note that the militias are part of a larger anti-government movement. They're a subsection or a subcategorization of that agenda or that ideology. And generally, these groups skyrocket in times of democratic administrations because they fear that the federal government will soon be coming for their guns. They fear that the federal government will be coming for their ammunition. And so in the midst of this very tense election cycle after 8 years of an Obama administration that saw extremism skyrocket, it really is troublesome to hear those comments from that soundbite.
We're talking to Ryan Lenz, who's a senior writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, talking about a marked increase in the number of militia groups over the last couple of years. We had a producer for the program get in touch with an actual militia member, a gentleman named Charles Keith Cottle. Talked to him earlier this week. Mr. Cottle is part of the American Military Emergency Response Group, or AMERG. He says that there are over 2,000 members currently in Georgia and thousands more across the Southeast. And Cottle says that his militia's goal is to prepare for a disaster that might be around the corner. Let's listen.
Everyone's gotten pretty lax and comfortable with the fact that they can go to an ATM and a grocery store and not have a problem. But all of a sudden, if that were no longer an option and life were changed, there's quite a few Americans that live under an umbrella, if you will, and they don't see things for what they are, and they don't really pay attention. But if something of that nature were to happen, I think it'd be a very rude awakening.
So, Ryan, I got to say, that part doesn't sound crazy to me. He's right. Our society really does depend on a lot of systems that could break down at any given time. However, I'm wondering if maybe the survivalist mission of some of these groups is actually a proxy for something else.
Well, interestingly enough, you know, the survivalism isn't extreme in and of itself, but it also often comes as part of a larger generalized fear. And as we heard in that soundbite, listen, the militias are built up for the purposes of giving a solution to everyone's fear that the federal government or that the systems that surround us will collapse. But there's an additional element to that collapse that is largely part of like the ideology, which is that the federal government is a tyrannical force seeking to undermine the American people or keep them as sheep or American citizen, quote unquote, prisoners. So, I mean, you're right. It's not unreasonable to think about preparing oneself for riots or civil unrest. I mean, we've seen in the last year that happen across the country, but there's something more nefarious at stake here when it comes to patriot militias who claim that they are here to provide the services that we all trust our, you know, trust our local, state, and federal government to provide.
Yeah, and I don't want to, I mean, I don't know enough about Mr. Cottle's organization to know whether or not this would apply to him, but it's certainly the case that some of the other groups that we have been talking about, the collapse that they fear is something that they're talking about bringing upon themselves. They're talking
Absolutely.
About bringing down the government, causing the very collapse for which they are trying to prepare. Let's talk about issues of race being intertwined with some of these groups. Let's hear more from this militia member, Charles Keith Cottle. Here he is talking about the idea that militias are often viewed as hate groups.
We're not racist at all. In fact, we don't allow people of that nature to join our group. We do background checks on everyone to see, you know, what they've participated in the past, what their beliefs are. We make sure that they're not, you know, former KKK members or LEO haters. We don't allow anyone that we consider to be, for lack of a better term, a loose cannon.
Now, without speaking to Mr. Cottle's group in Georgia in particular, just generally speaking, Ryan, what does the Southern Poverty Law Center's research say about racism and militia groups? Is there a link?
Well, Mr. Cottle is right. I mean, most of the militia groups that exist today are not, quote-unquote, hate groups. They're not racist organizations, and there's nothing in their ideologies or in their driving purpose that is racist or racial in origin.
And, of course, your organization tracks hate groups. That's another big thing that you do, so you would know.
That's correct. And so they're basically two branches on a tree of extremism. And they might have, you know, they might have historic overlap, but there is absolutely no overlap right now.
Hmm. Okay.
On the historic overlap, I'm talking about various anti-government groups in the 70s and 80s, the Posse Comitatus, okay, which had at its core doctrine this idea that Jewish bankers were behind the collapse of farms across America. That's a very, very distinct racial component that is absent from a lot of the militia ideology today.
Sure. Well, where do you see this trend going, regardless of who gets elected president?
Well, I think who gets elected president will determine this. Will be quite a driver in how this plays out.
Point taken.
Yeah, I mean, as I said earlier in the segment, you know, in times of Democratic presidencies, militia groups tend to skyrocket. We saw it at the, you know, with the election of President Barack Obama, anti-government groups of which militias are a part rose to historic levels, upwards of over 1,200 groups in the nation. So that's fallen a little bit in the last couple of years, but it really all depends on which direction the people that populate these militias feel the country is going. Is it going in the direction of collapse? Is it going in the direction of the federal government coming for our guns in the wake of all these mass shootings? Those are the drivers that push people into these groups.
Sure. It certainly strikes me, though, that even if the polls are right and Hillary Clinton wins the presidency in November, that Trump may go away, but Trumpism is not going to go away. It speaks to something that is part of our society and will be part of our society for a while. So I really appreciate having you there to work, do this work at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Ryan Lenz writes for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Just ahead, the high-profile case that pitted an Emory professor against a Holocaust denier. But first, the hosts of the true crime podcast Undisclosed join us to talk about their investigation into a Georgia man's murder. This is On Second Thought. True crime junkies have a relatively new way to get their fix. With podcasts, the popularity of podcasts like Serial and Criminal have taken off in recent years. The podcast Undisclosed covers criminal convictions where there is room for doubt. And it's dedicated its second season to a 16-year-old Georgia murder case. Joey Watkins of Rome, Georgia, is currently serving a life sentence for a number of charges, including the murder of 20-year-old Isaac Dawkins. But there are a number of questions about Watkins' guilt, ones that the Georgia Innocence Project have tried to answer with the help of the Undisclosed podcast team. And here to talk more about the case is Susan Simpson and Colin Miller, co-hosts of Undisclosed. Susan joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Glad to have you. Also, Colin is joining us by Skype from the Kennedy Greenhouse Studio at the University of South Carolina. Hi, Colin.
Hey, how's it going?
Doing okay. Also with us in GPB's Atlanta studio is Clara Gilbert. She is the interim director of the Georgia Innocence Project. Thanks for being here, Claire.
Hi, thank you.
Susan, let's just dive right in and do the short version of what happened in this case. Where does the story begin?
This case goes back to January 2000, when a college student named Isaac Dawkins was driving home from college one evening. His car crashed off the side of the road, and about 2 hours later, they discovered that he hadn't just wrecked. It had actually been a gunshot. He died the following day, and shortly thereafter, or even before that, the investigation focused on Joey Watkins, another teenager from the Rome area, as the lead suspect. Joey and Isaac had known each other. They weren't friends, and they'd recently had a feud of sorts, although in the past months, immediately before the murder, there hadn't seemed to be much interaction between them. Nevertheless, for the next 10 months, they focused the investigation on Joey and ultimately arrested him. And in 2001, he was convicted.
Let's take a listen to the 911 call from the scene where Isaac Dawkins' truck crashed into that wooded area off of US 27 near Rome.
911.
Yes, I just called about the car wreck.
Ma'am, are you there right beside him?
I'm in the car. I can't get to him.
Okay. Can somebody please get to him with a cell phone so we can help him?
I'm talking to him now. He's not breathing good. He's out cold.
Susan, did the authorities ever look at anyone other than Joey Watkins, or did they think that it was Joey from the beginning?
Well, they did initially. Obviously, Joey was a prime suspect from the start, but when the Rome Police Department had the case in the first 7 weeks after Isaac's death, they did, in fact, investigate a number of suspects and followed quite a few leads. It wasn't until the Floyd County Police Department took over the case beginning in March of 2000 that Joey became the sole suspect, or rather the sole person of interest along with possible accomplices. Eventually, they did settle on another man named Mark Free, Joey's friend, as the trigger man in the killing. But he was actually tried after Joey and acquitted of this murder.
Now, Susan, I know that you're from Georgia originally. What else got you involved into this case? What made you want to cover it on your podcast?
The number one thing that caught my interest, we asked for submissions for cases for a second season as we were finishing up our last season following the Nan Syed case, which was also covered in Serial. And we got a lot of responses, but Claire was the only attorney of anyone who reached out to us and said, hey, we have a case we'd like you to look at. And to me, that was really important. And I really wanted to look more into this case when I saw that the attorneys were on board with having us cover it.
Yeah. So, Claire, tell us about how the Georgia Innocence Project got involved in Joey Watkins' case.
Well, we first heard from Joey probably around 2010 when he just sent us a letter. We get roughly 8 letters a day, about 160 a month, and his was just one of those with claims that he was innocent of the murder that he was convicted and imprisoned on. And we processed that like our other cases, began looking into it. But we have many, many cases, and it was just one of many. And what really stood out and struck us was that a couple years later in 2012, we were contacted by an attorney by the name of Bill O'Dell, who is actually co-counsel in Joey's case and lead counsel in Mark Free's case. Mark Free was the shooter the alleged shooter who was acquitted. And Bill O'Dell had maintained a very strong belief in Joey's innocence all these years and was in the process of convening a group of people together to approach the Georgia Bureau of Investigations to open an investigation into Joey's case and see what had gone wrong and see if they could try and figure out who the real killer was. As part of that, he invited the Georgia Innocence Project and other attorneys and people who might have an interest in the case to petition the GBI, who ultimately declined to open an investigation for a number of reasons. But that is what started our interest in the case.
I think before we proceed, we should hear Joey Watkins' voice. Here's Joey Watkins himself speaking on the first episode of this season's podcast, Undisclosed.
I don't claim to be perfect. I'm not an angel. But, you know, I didn't kill nobody. I don't know. I've matured. I've matured a lot faster in here than I guess I would have if I'd have been home. But I see myself why they looked at me. But when it came down to it, they should have seen the truth.
That's Joey Watkins of Rome, Georgia, who is currently serving a lengthy sentence for a murder that he says he did not commit. And the subject of, and Joey, his case is the subject of the podcast Undisclosed, which is hosted by Colin Miller and Susan Simpson, who are our guests here on Second Thought. Also with us is Claire Gilbert of the Georgia Innocence Project, which is working with the podcast on Joey's case and investigating what's going on there. Colin, let me turn to you. What is it about a podcast that you think lends itself toward investigating a case like this?
I think it is the nature of the medium where listeners can really get engaged in the story, and through that medium, they can then look into the case themselves online and look into these old news articles, and they can see documents that we post associated with the case, and it allows them to engage in a way that older forms of media didn't allow them to do.
It's also iterative, right? It's episodic. So you can jump into this and start looking into the case and provide the people with updates as you go without necessarily having to know at the outset what the outcome of your investigation is going to be.
Right. This goes all the way back to the old school radio programs of the 1920s and 30s, where people had that idea of tuning in every week and seeing what's going to happen next. And I think that is something where they feel very much this is an evolving story and they can play a part in it. We've gotten a lot of great information from listeners. They can watch as this story unfolds in real time. And I think that's something that really gets people excited about this podcast.
One of the most iconic things about the Serial podcast that everyone knows was listening to the Serial team get Adnan Syed on the phone via collect call from the prison. That's how they were able to communicate with him. How are you communicating with Joey Watkins? How are you getting this tape? That tape that we just heard did not sound like it was over the phone.
It's really interesting. We've been working closely with the Georgia Department of Corrections, and they have allowed, we basically provided Joey's counselors at Walker State Prison, where he is currently housed, with some Skype equipment, a microphone, and showed them how to load Skype onto the computer. And then we schedule times and calls with the warden, get a warden's approval, then go through Joey's counselor, and I'm Skyping from my computer. This is Claire Gilbert with the Georgia Innocence Project. Susan is Skyping from her computer, and Joey is Skyping from the counselor's office inside the prison.
Claire, you are Joey, or you're functioning as Joey's attorney in this situation. What does, you know, taking your conversation and putting on a podcast, what implications does that have for the nature of your attorney-client privilege?
Well, the whole relationship with the podcast was very scary to me at first, and I was actually opposed to it when we first, one of our other colleagues, Christina Cribbs, who used to work at Georgia Innocence Project, is the one who suggested it. And I was very uncomfortable with it at first, but the more I looked into Joey's case and stronger it seemed to me to be, and how the allegations that the state was making were not panning out, coupled with the realization that his legal avenues had all pretty much come to a grinding halt without significant new evidence, we determined that it really might be in Joey's best interest, and ultimately that it was in his best interest, to reach out to the podcast the consequences are fairly great in that it does destroy a lot of attorney-client privilege. There's no attorney-client privilege in these conversations. I'm not sitting there next to Joey. If he starts saying something that I don't want him to say, I can't control it.
You can't give him the cut it off. Stop talking, body language.
Yeah,
right?
And he likes to talk. But we decided that this was a leap that we were going to take. And we're ready for what may come.
We're speaking with the co-hosts of a podcast called Undisclosed, Colin Miller and Susan Simpson. This podcast looks at people who've been convicted of crimes where there's some room to doubt whether the conviction was legitimate, and they have been, as part of their current season, looking into the conviction of a Georgia man named Joey Watkins. And we're also speaking to Claire Gilbert of the Georgia Innocence Project, who is working on that case and working with Colin and Susan on the podcast. Colin or Susan, whoever wants to answer this question, one of the criticisms that I think has been levied against shows like yours is that they tend to weight sympathy in favor of the accused because the accused is still alive and you can speak to Joey and we can hear Joey and hear Joey's side of the story. The victim is gone. You can't talk to the victim on your podcast. And as a result, despite your best efforts at fairness, the impact on the audience may be to have their emotions tilted in favor of the accused, who, in fact, may have done it.
Well, first, I'd say that in some respects, this is no different from what happens in regular trials when typically and historically, it's been the prosecutors control the media narratives and who, even in advance of picking a jury, have been able to have media coverage painting the defendant in negative light, suggesting their involvement. So it's not unusual or unheard or somehow improper to have public coverage of a criminal case like this. And I'd also say that it's so not about the victim versus the defendant. There's two victims in this case, I firmly believe, and we're seeking justice for both of them.
So you believe that Joey is innocent?
I do. After looking at the evidence, after reviewing all the files, I don't see much room for doubt in this case.
Colin, are you in the same place?
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. There's a number of pieces of evidence that pretty strongly point to innocence, including the fact that the main eyewitness to the murder who saw the shooting says that he saw the shooter in basically a little blue Honda, and no one over all these years has been able to link any vehicle matching that general description to Joey Watkins. And in fact, he showed up at his girlfriend's house in a truck very soon after the shooting. And so you'd have to imagine some type of case of musical vehicles occurring in a very short time span that just doesn't really seem to make much sense.
Colin, talk to me about some of the other criticisms that have been levied against shows like yours that, despite your best efforts at doing serious investigative journalism with a podcast, the nature of the medium just lends itself toward some degree of journalism for the sake of entertainment, really kind of turning something, despite any of your best efforts, into kind of a crime novella, a true crime, rather than a piece of investigative journalism that can come across much more dry when it's written on the page.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing in that sense is I always envisioned the podcast as the antithesis of that, in the sense that I'm a law professor, and my goal primarily in the podcast is to educate people about the law. And our last few episodes have been about character evidence. And we've had our listeners reaching out and saying, you got into the law a good amount, but actually we'd like you to dig deeper into the law and explain what's a grand jury, what's character evidence, what's the expert evidence standard. So we try very hard in our podcast to make it as much as possible about educating the public about the law, as opposed to doing something more salacious and something that sort of resembles a soap opera more.
Susan, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think we're very much a departure from the whole true crime narrative in that we're focusing on this in some respects, professionals. I'm an attorney, Colin's a law professor, Rabia is also an attorney, and this is how we approach cases for our jobs. This is how we now analyze the law. This is how we look at the case record. And yes, it's interesting material, obviously, but it's not sensationalized for the sake of that.
And this
Claire is, Gilbert. So go ahead, Claire.
I just wanted to point out that the fact that there is so much drama in this case has to do with why and how Joey got convicted. I mean, it's the character evidence, it's the similar transaction evidence that came in and shifted the jury's attention away from the fact that there really was no evidence that Joey committed this crime.
Yeah, in our last 30 seconds here, Claire Gilbert of the Georgia Innocence Project, where does Joey's case go from here?
Well, thanks to the investigations of the podcast and the input that we are getting from people who've been listening to the podcast and the work we've been doing, we have uncovered some pretty significant new evidence in the case, which is the standard for getting back into court. So we have a new fellow that is working with us, and we're working with a volunteer attorney, and we plan to be back into court in the near future.
All right. Well, that is Claire Gilbert of the Georgia Innocence Project. She's the interim director. We also heard from Colin Miller and Susan Simpson of the podcast Undisclosed. Their current season is covering the case of Joey Watkins of Rome, Georgia. You can learn more about the Georgia Innocence Project at the Oakhurst Porch Fest in Decatur on October 8th. Thanks to all three of you. Just ahead, another story about crime and punishment. This is On Second Thought. Now, Emory University professor Deborah Lipstadt found herself at the center of a unique legal battle 16 years ago. A libel case pitted her against a Holocaust denier, and their trial quickly attracted international attention. Lipstadt wrote about it in her book, History on Trial. That's now been adapted into a new film called Denial. It stars Academy Award winner Rachel Weisz playing Lipstadt.
Deborah, I have to warn you that there's a reason why he's bringing the case in London.
I wondered about that.
Yes, to his advantage. Over here in America, if you're accused of defaming someone, then it's up to them to prove that what you said is untrue. In the UK, the reverse is true.
Wait, I have to prove what I said was true?
Correct.
Yes, but I'm the innocent party. A man accuses you of something and it's your job to prove he's wrong? It's against natural justice. In the US, there's a presumption of innocence.
Yeah, not in the UK.
Denial opens in theaters on Friday, and Deborah Lipstadt, the real Deborah Lipstadt, joins us now to talk about her story that has now landed on the big screen. Good morning, Deborah.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. The man who accused you of libel is a guy named David Irving. Here he is in a BBC radio interview explaining why he went after you.
Lipstadt is part of an international conspiracy to silence me and destroy my career. And I could look up the slope and see this mudslide thundering down towards me and about to engulf me totally and wipe me out. And I decided the time had come to start hammering pegs into the landscape, as David Lipstadt now knows. When people use their Jewish networking to disadvantage David Irving gets up and fights back.
And in the film, we first meet David Irving in a scene where you are giving a lecture. A person in the audience asks why in your writing you disparage Irving's work where he denies the Holocaust, and here is your response as portrayed in the film.
To be honest, I don't think I do denigrate him. Actually, I don't really think about him that much. I don't think he's important. Yes, sir, gentleman in the back.
Professor Lipstadt, let me reveal something to you, Professor. I am that David Irving about whom you have been so rude. Yes, I am he. And it puzzles me that you think yourself qualified to attack me, given that I have 30 years' experience in the archives. And my books have been published by some of the greatest publishing houses in the world. Viking Press, William Morrow, E.P. Dutton. I have to conclude that the reason you don't engage with people you disagree with is because you can't.
Now, Deborah Lipstadt, we're going to talk about all the very serious issues raised by your story about the nature of Holocaust denial, the nature of libel laws. But first, I think I just have to ask you the question that probably everyone and your mother has been asking you for a while now, which is, what was it like to see this very, very difficult part of your life portrayed by a Hollywood film?
It was an out-of-body experience. It was very strange. But it wasn't like I signed over the book and then sat down in the theater a couple of years later and saw the film. I was very lucky. I was brought into the production of the film David Hare, the screenwriter, who did a magnificent job with the screenplay and much of the film, the text of the film, comes from the actual transcripts of the trial, shared various drafts with me. It came to Atlanta, followed me around, saw me teach at Emory, talked to my students, talked to my colleagues. And then Rachel Weisz brought me into, at the very beginning, as soon as she started preparing for the role, I spent a couple of days with her at her home. She would call me before she did a certain scene. I'd often be on the set. So it wasn't a complete surprise yet. The first time I sat down to see it on a big screen with a test audience of about 500 people, it was very weird.
But did it put you back in the mindset of the time and provoke feelings of anxiety? Did it sort of, was it there a little bit of PTSD there?
No, it didn't provoke feelings of anxiety because I know the ending. So, spoiler alert, I win. But it did. It was difficult, especially watching Timothy Spall's unbelievable recreation of David Irving. It reminded me of why this man is so contemptible. You pick up a bit of it in the clip you just played. He is a conspiracy theorist. He's a racist. He's an anti-Semite. And he lies, and then he believes what he says.
We're speaking to Emory University professor Deborah Lipstadt. She is the inspiration behind the film Denial that opens in theaters on Friday. It chronicles her experience when this Holocaust denier sued her for libel for basically saying that basically saying everything she just said about him just now. Deborah, take us back to the beginning. Where does this particular strain of Holocaust denial come from? There must be some intellectual basis for
Well,
it.
I don't know if you could give, we can append to conspiracy theories an intellectual basis, because it's a very skewed vision of the world, whether it's a conspiracy theory about the Holocaust, whether it's a conspiracy theory about 9/11, about vaccines, about Sandy Hook, the town in Connecticut where those children were murdered, which now mm-hmm. some conspiracy theorists say was all a setup, you know, to get gun control legislation and things like that. Conspiracy theorists have a very skewed view of the world. You know, the moon landing was in, I forget if it's Utah or Nevada or whatever, those kind of things. So I wouldn't give it an intellectual basis, but what I would say is that Holocaust denial is a form of anti-Semitism. You know, it wants to deny that the Jews suffered, and it wants to claim that Jews who today talk about the Holocaust are doing this to get special privilege, to get sympathy of the world. It's not dissimilar to people who don't deny that slavery took place, but they'll tell you, oh, slavery really was not so bad. You know, the slaves had 3 square meals. They had a place to live. They could sit around the campfire at night and sing all those pretty songs. So let's not feel so bad. It's a recreation of what was, a rewriting of what was.
Now, David Irving sued you for libel. Libel means it means that you have he's accusing you of having defamed him in writing. Libel's always written, right?
Right, correct.
Defamed him in writing, and what we mean by defamation is that you have said stuff about him that, or written stuff about him that is discrediting and this is the really important part, false. Right?
That's
correct. It's not defamation if I say stuff that's bad about you that's also true.
That's correct.
So the nature of this trial fundamentally came down to determining whether or not it really is true that the Holocaust happened, right?
Well, we try to stay away from that. The strategy of my magnificent legal team was we had to prove that what I said was right. And the way we did it, and that's why I originally called my book History on Trial, which has now been reissued as Denial, was to follow the footnotes. You know, we followed the footnotes back to their sources. So each time David Irving said, I can prove that, you know, there were no gas chambers, or I can prove that Hitler tried to stop the riots in November, the riots and pogroms and killings in November 1938, I have a document which proves it. We would follow that back to the original document. And not in most instances, and not in the preponderance of instances, but in every single instance where we went back to a source, Universe, where he wrote something about the Holocaust. We found an invention, a misstatement of fact, an inversion of dates, putting people at a meeting who weren't there. It's what our expert witness, Cambridge University professor Richard Evans, called a tissue of lies. And the judge agreed with that 100%.
Let's listen to another clip from the film Denial that is opening in theaters on Friday. This is the film about your real life experience. During the trial, you did not take the witness stand, which was a point of contention between you and your legal team. So here's a scene from the film in which Rachel Weisz, who's playing you, and actor Tom Wilkinson is playing your attorney, Richard Rampton.
Our strategy is to keep the focus on Irving and Irving alone. It's not a test of your credibility, it's a test of his.
You don't think I'm good enough?
No. I didn't say that at all. Everything you have to say, you've said in your book. Our task is to starve Irving, and putting you in a witness box would feed him. This case is happening to you, but it's not about you.
My guest is Emory University professor Deborah Lipstadt. A new movie called Denial chronicles her time in the middle of a libel trial between her and a Holocaust denier, and that was an actor playing her in the film that opens on Friday. Deborah, why did you ultimately decide not to present your own evidence in this case?
Well, it wasn't that I decided. I was told quite specifically by the lawyers that they were not going to call me. In British law...
You didn't have some choice about it?
I didn't have it. I kept saying, I want to go on. Look, at some point, you've got to trust the experts. It was hard for me. It's hard for me to trust anyone to take control of something about my life.
Well, also, you're a lawyer. I mean, doctors are the worst patients,
no,
right?
No, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a history professor. No,
oh,
no.
I'm sorry.
The only thing I know about law is about being sued, you know, and being turned down for jury duty. I've been turned down 3 times, so I think I'm out. They said, they made it very clear. It took me a long time to accept it because I was really afraid people would say I was a coward. But as Richard Rampton or Tom Wilkinson says in the clip you just played, it wasn't about me, and I had to keep sort of my eye on the prize, as we say, and that was on winning this case. And what they argued is you're being sued for what you wrote in your book. We have to prove that what you wrote in your book, i.e. that David Irving is a Holocaust denier, an anti-Semite, a racist, and that he lies and he does it deliberately, won't be helped by your going on the stand. We want to keep the focus on the book and on what you wrote. And at some point, rather reluctantly, I had to accept that. I knew people wondered why I didn't go on. I wasn't talking to the press either. And I have a lot of friends who say that the greatest miracle of this whole case was that I kept my mouth shut during this period. I understood. I understood. It took me a long while, as the movie makes clear. But at some point, I understood I had the best lawyers, and they knew what they were doing. And I had to let them run it as they thought best.
Let's listen to your attorney, Richard Rampton. This is the real Richard Rampton, not the actor from the movie. Here's Richard talking about a key piece of evidence in the case with the BBC. The key evidence was Irving's diaries, which Rampton described as a gold mine in this case. Let's listen.
Because what they showed was, first, that he was an enthusiastic participator in events organized by neo-Nazis and right-wing extremists. But second, which did surprise us perhaps a little more, was that according to what he had written, he was profoundly anti-Semitic, which does rather suggest a motive for his adulation of Hitler.
So, Deborah, spell this out. You've talked about this a little bit, but just this is such a complicated case. Make it clear. If this was a libel case where you had to prove in a sense that the Holocaust actually existed, why were these diaries relevant?
The diaries were relevant because they showed intention. They showed intention. In the diaries, we kept finding overt anti-Semitism, including songs he sang that he made up for his daughter, which were both racist and anti-Semitic. We found that he spent time when he came to this country. He would come here. He would vacation very often in Key West. And he had an admirer in New Orleans who would come down to visit him, and that was David Duke. He spoke to far right wing extremist groups. I'm not talking conservative. I'm talking far right wing, white supremacist, racist groups when he came to this country. So we showed that this man, though on the surface, he acted like he was a very respectable writer of historical works. but that he had this other life, which very much infected what he did and what he wrote and what he said. So we were able to show that connection quite strongly.
And because libel cases hinge on the question of veracity, this also spoke to the veracity of your claim that he was an anti-Semite.
That's right. That's right. And again, we also showed, we went in thinking we would prove just that he was an anti-Semite. But as we went through the material, I mean, I have made the case in my original book, the book that caused the suit, that many white supremacists like Holocaust denial because it sort of validates Hitler had very contemptuous feelings towards quote-unquote people of color and black people particularly. And he always wanted to show them as inferior. So Holocaust deniers also like to, you know, connect with the white supremacist movement. So we were proving both. And the diaries really were a gold mine. And I never saw the diaries. I never was even in the same room with the diaries. But the lawyers and the experts went through them and found just damning evidence.
Your judge in this case was a gentleman named Charles Gray. And after the trial ended, he talked with the BBC just to make it clear this is the real Charles Gray, not the portrayal of Charles Gray in the movie Denial that opens up on Friday. The real guy. Let's listen.
I've had my share, I think, of quite large libel actions. None quite so substantial, I think, as the Irving trial. A unique case. One can't imagine that there'll be many other cases, whether in the guise of a libel action or anything else, which will raise the same sort of often horrifying issues as that case did.
So, Deborah, have there been lasting effects in the legal community from your case?
I think so. There have been some effects on libel law in England or cumulative. My trial was part of a cumulative impact, which now makes it a little harder to sue for libel because it puts such a burden on the defendant. But in terms of history, this I can speak to much with much more expertise. It's given the lie to what I call hardcore Holocaust denial. Those people who say, you know, there were no gas chambers, the Germans never intended to kill the Jews. Hitler, as David Irving would say, was the best friend the Jews had. David Irving, by suing me, and I'm so glad you mentioned that and repeated that, and I want to stress that, because there are people who think I sued him, but I don't.
Right.
I don't believe in history in the courtroom. I think they're two separate entities. By suing me, made a mistake, because suddenly lies he'd been saying and statements he'd been saying were now being checked, and people were asking questions. And just because you say, you know, it goes to a contemporary situation, the difference between fact, opinion, and lies. If I said to you, it's my opinion that the earth is flat, you would say, Deborah, that's not an opinion. That's craziness. But it speaks to that. And he went into a courtroom where there was a judge who would determine that what he was saying was based on lies and was falsification of history, which he did deliberately.
Emory University professor Deborah Lipstadt is the inspiration behind the film Denial. That movie chronicles her experience being sued for libel by a Holocaust denier. The film is showing in select theaters, opens on Friday. Deborah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Adam. I appreciate it.